You know, you gotta be careful and really get that L in gold, don't you? And look up.
Yeah, I know. This has been said, actually.
Oh, very good. Okay.
David, please go ahead.
Good morning. How are you? You guys are tough, hardcore. Start at 8 o'clock, and it'll be my goal for this talk not to give anyone the ability to come up with a 10-point list. So, that's what I'm going to try and do. I'm from Syracuse and Syracuse University, where we've had our first snowfall. And so when my wife heard that I was going down to speak at Charleston, where the average temperature is 70 right about now, she said, "Prove it." So if you don't mind, thank you. Good morning. I'm here to talk about massive scale librarianship and try and explain what that is. And I represent not only myself, but a really talented group of students, master students at Syracuse, who have been thinking about this issue in IST 676, which is our digital libraries class. And so anything that I say that is wrong, I would normally take blame for, but I'm tenured and I don't have to. So the two URLs you see here, Drew, Syracuse MSL, is more information about this topic, and then that's my URL at the bottom where you can get copies of the slides. We'll also make sure they're available online in the system. And it might be interesting to ask, why is it that I'm doing this sort of in conjunction with a digital libraries class? Shouldn't I be talking about metadata and scanning and these kinds of things? And the answer is no. But part of it was a realization that if you sort of look out a little bit about where digital libraries are going, and I noticed that there's some presentations on digital libraries that I hope to get to later, there's a sort of interesting extreme that we're going to. If you look at how we're building up the concepts of digital libraries with metadata and with mass scale scanning and these things, the notion that right now we look at digital libraries as dealing with thousands and thousands of document-like objects. And what we started thinking about with this class was what happens when thousands and thousands turns into millions and millions and millions of millions turns into billions and billions, and then we're in Carl Sagan land. And what happens when they're no longer document-like objects? And so the concept sort of went from there. And let me give you some specific examples to sort of lay out what I'm talking about. How many people, in essence, had wheels under them at some point this morning to get to the conference? You drove in, you took a shuttle, you had a Segway, you're one of the three, okay. What's interesting is I've had the good fortune of working with the Transportation Research Board and a bunch of departments of transportation. And I have to admit that coming from the library world, I thought we had acronyms. You would not believe the amount and number of letters that are associated with asphalt alone. And we were part of a study group looking at information management in the transportation industry. We said what happened was in transportation, this is not unlike an unusual story in many settings, there were lots of closures of libraries. There were closures at the FAA. There were closures at different departments of transportation. There was a discussion about how could libraries be relevant and how do we deal with this masses of information. A lot of things that we just heard about in open access, that someone does a study. There was a great study done that if you adopted this way of paving a road from Europe, you could save $6 million a year. And that was known and it was out there, and if only someone had found that study, imagine the cost savings we could have had nationwide. So familiar stuff to us. And so we started looking at, well, how do we build library networks and how do we make it so that it's seamless access and we can have finding aids and bibliographic record sharing and really all this wonderful stuff that, you know, there's a great saying that vendors say that when you get four librarians in a bar, it's called a consortium. You know, how could we build a consortium of this? And as we were talking about it, as we were thinking about it, we know how to do this, and we were going down the road, and okay, we can do this and that and this and that. It suddenly struck us that we were missing the big picture. The big picture is that soon, as in very soon, if not already, every mile of roadway will generate a gigabyte of data a day. Right? Now, you're saying, Dave, they don't generate anything. They sit there and we drive over them, but stick with me for a moment. When you go to put a road in these days, the first thing you have to do is an environmental impact study. So you have reams and reams of data of where the spotted owls are living and how best to hit them with your bulldozers. enter red state, blue state comment here. just so many ways I go with that. But the notion of you've got this environmental data, you have GIS data, you have the idea of where that road goes, you have it down to the point, you have resources. Are there archaeological finds here? Are there historical significant finds? After you do that, you actually get into the point of putting the roadway down. You have the contract negotiations, the contracts that happened, what materials were used, how those materials were used, where did you buy the materials, which becomes very important if you live in Boston. I mean, I drove in from the airport, and it's just like... the notion of where we can find these, I don't know, but in many states, if you're an architect and you build a building and it falls down 30 years ago and they found out it's your design flaw, you're still liable. So imagine keeping that information for 30 years. But once again, back to the roadway. When you put down the asphalt these days, the worst thing you can do, now in here you guys don't worry about it. Here up in New York we worry about a lot. You put salt on the roadways when they freeze. That's when it gets cold. I'll go slow. Anyway, the problem is salt, not such a nice thing for things like water and that you want to drink and for animals. And so you want to put the least salt amount as possible. So now when you're putting down asphalt, you're embedding them with little sensors. And all those sensors say is things like the temperature. But what that means is from a network standpoint, you can be sitting alone in your shed full of salt and wait for that piece of roadway to freeze before you go out and actually salt it. So you use less salt. And what's interesting, I found out, is Department of Transportation hate putting their employees on their roads because it's, wait for it, too dangerous. So now you have all this sensor information telling you, salt me, I'm ready to crack. You know, it's this whole usage. And not only this, but if you're in a big metropolitan area, we put cameras on them. So you can look in the morning and say, well, I guess I'll wait 2 hours there or I'll wait 2 hours at home before I go to work. We have the idea of toll data. That in New York, if you go from Maine down to New Jersey and probably even further, you have these little RFID tags that you don't have to stop. They just automatically charge you. Well, that's really interesting data. And it turns out it's really, really interesting data because it gets used in all sorts of unusual ways, some very serious. There was a district attorney prosecuting a mob crime who disappeared one day from court. The way they found his body was they found out what exit they got off last by his toll data. Increasingly, New York State's worried about this toll data because they get subpoenas every day from divorce lawyers. There's a really slightly grim story, but you got to smile. The idea that one day a family had the grandmother pass away, they took down the RFID tag, they put it in a foil wrapper, they sent it back to Albany, which is where it needs to go, and it got charged each stop on the way to Albany. So there's lots of information that going on. Cars, your black boxes, all this. The idea is it really is generating a gigabyte of data a day. Now, it's not generating a nice progressive report with seams and bindings and such. Some of it's just numbers. And those numbers, maybe we keep, maybe we don't. But it's interesting is the minute those numbers exist, people want to keep them. And we have to, in these days of homeland security, the idea of what we throw away is very interesting. The answer is usually nothing. We want to keep it all. It's assumed that this gigabyte per hour will soon become, or gigabyte a day will soon become a gigabyte per hour. At 3.5 million of highway alone in the US, that would be 3.3 petabytes of data per hour, or 28 exabytes of data per year. If you don't know your Greek, everyone knows this one. It's a byte. It's basically one byte, one character. Or byte a character. But anyway, a kilobyte, 2 kilobytes about a typewritten page. We then move on to a megabyte. 2 megabytes is a high-resolution photograph. A gigabyte, 2 gigabytes would be 20 meters of shelved books. Now you can see that this is not going in a nice little line. A terabyte, 2 terabytes is an academic research library. If you scanned it and stored it as text, I mean, I understand we can have that, but it gives you a sense of scale. 1 petabyte, 2 petabytes is all U.S. academic libraries, research libraries. An exabyte, 5 exabytes, all words ever spoken by humans. Or, taking us back to our previous, 1/4 of the amount of data that our roads will be talking about. Just in case you're curious, zettabytes and yottabytes are yet to come. Data storage you will have, yes? Okay. The point of each of these are storage estimates, and you already noticed that if you've watched your computer, you keep going through this, right? It's amazing how we can keep filling it up with junk, but we're going through it, right? And to the point now that if I bought a new Mac today, I would get a 160 gigabyte hard drive. Now, enter standard story about when I was a boy, we had a 2K hard drive and we liked it, right? But the notion that not only can we store this stuff, but this is also processing power. It's how many bits per second that we can process. The idea of MIPS and GIPS and all these other things that we're really talking about. We are now at the end, which is kind of scary, of the terascale computing sector, right? Your computer that you have on your desk can probably handle gigascale, number of instructions per second. But already the research community has said, we're done with terascale, we're moving to petascale computing. Right? Each one of these is an order of magnitude larger. This is a geometric progression. And what's interesting is human beings are not wired to deal with geometric progressions. So I want you to do a little thought experiment in your mind. Imagine that you had a really, really big piece of paper, but it was only 1/100th of an inch thick, which is about what a standard sheet of paper is. Okay? So as big as this room. What I want you to do is, in your mind, I want you to fold it. With me so far? Now I want you to fold it again, and I want you to fold it for 50 times. Okay? Okay. How tall would that paper be? Any guesses? If you've read the book, I don't want to hear it. That was too quick. What's that? No. Just fold it in half.
Like this?
Yes. This is a tough group. You fold it in half, you fold it in half again. Most people will say things like, about that high, really high. It would approximate the distance between the Earth and the Sun.
I think we should give that lady a free Charleston pen.
Could we pen her, please? It's a geometric progression. 1/100th of an inch becomes, 0.2, 0.5, and it's sort of this nice little graph that suddenly shoots up at the end, where you start talking in miles. 800 million miles high. By the way, don't try this at home, because it turns out it gets geometrically taller, it also gets geometrically narrower, and by the time you're done, you're at about the width of an atom, and physically you can't fold something that's... Anyway. But my point is, that geometric progression is the same thing that we're seeing in computer processing and computer storage. So when people talk about terascale computing and petascale computing, we decided to just jump the gun and call it massive scale computing. And because, we don't want to have to keep changing the letterhead, right? We originally called it N-scale computing. Everyone said, that's great, you're working with model trains. I said, no, big, or massive. So massive scale computing. This is what we're facing, right? And what's interesting is, when we talk about this gigabytes and terabytes and exabytes of data per day, the way we used to talk about it was, what do we get rid of? All right, we need it for a day, but we can't store it. Let's eliminate it. We'll scan this stuff and we can get rid of this. We talk about it as a choice. We have to choose what amongst this exabytes of data we want to store and keep. And what I'm arguing is, in the very near term, you will no longer have to choose. What is a world like when you can have exabytes of data on your hard drive, in your iPod, listening to exabytes of Weird Al Yankovic songs? What is it like? What do we do? How do we deal with that world? And now this is based on something, this is predictable change. This is not sci-fi land. Oh, great, Dave, big storage, great, thanks, heard it. And we'll have flying cars. There's a very smart man who worked for Intel by the name of Moore, that came up with what he called Moore's Law. And Moore's Law says that every 24 months, the density of processors you can put on a chip doubles, or the cost to put the same number of processors goes in half. That's a geometric progression. And what's amazing is, if you look at that nice little round circle, it's true. That if you look at the computing power and density of processor chips, we have not only kept up with Moore's Law, they now talk about it in 18-month cycle as opposed to 24-month cycle. The amount of information published doubles every 18 months. So the notion of, well, what about all our books? I love books. I'm really concerned that we preserve the information. I'm a little bit more worried about all the digital information that we're producing on a regular basis that is this exponential growth curve. Right? What do we do? By the way, storage is exceeding Moore's Law. Our hard drives are actually getting more dense and able to handle more information than they did before. And it's going to keep going. Every time we think we've hit the edge, someone's come up with some clever little way of using lasers or something to do it. Now, here's the deal. There are lots of issues that we have to face in a world like this. Privacy. The DARPA and the Defense Agency announced the idea of the Total Information Awareness Network. I know those are small, so I'll read them for you. And that was the idea that why don't we just go ahead and we can hook up to the internet like everyone else and we'll just dump every piece of data ever. And in fact, we'll go to AT&T and we'll go to all these other places and we'll get all the phone calls and data there too. And any data that flows through those networks, we can capture. There's nothing illegal to the idea of capturing email transiting over your system. So why not just do it? Now, the wiretapping thing, I'm not there yet. But anyway, that's kind of scary. What does privacy look like when we look at all the data we generate? My class and I were helping to organize this session, they said, this is what we should do. We should get a list of participants, and we'll go, and then what you could do at the thing is we'll say, could I have everyone from Arizona stand up? Could I have everyone who lives on this street stand up? And then just start telling them what their mortgage payments were. And the person I sent that email to asking the registration list is going, oh, thank God I didn't get to that. But I did notice it's in the program. So for next year, we will be talking about your credit card debt in front of everyone else. But it's amazing when you think about it. We don't think about privacy of information, but imagine what's out there. If you go to Zillow, you can see what is your mortgage payment because it's public records. And we're never really worried about public records and what's a public record until suddenly we bring them all together and people go, oh, my God. Right? So you end up with the idea of the ethics of involvement, right? The idea that, well, we'll get to that in a second. We get to the idea of commercialization and scarcity, right? How do we deal with, all right, Dave, we have these exabytes and exabytes of data and they're out there, but the deal is we can't necessarily afford it all because even though we have the storage capacity, it's commercial. And the example we have there is a student who is doing a dissertation on, there are going to be a lot of weather examples too, meteorological data, and the student wanted to find out, get radar data, to find out if she could make a model of weather more accurate using, you know, the fabulous Doppler radar. And when she went to gather this information, she found out that the radar network in this country is owned and proprietary, and all that data you have to pay for. It used to be run publicly, and then it just, yeah, we'll let the commercial group do it, and now they can't get it for research. So we have to worry about those barriers. And by the way, I'm also not anti-capitalist. I don't think this is something where we have to get rid of commercial data, but it's an issue that we have to wrestle with, which is in massive scale data sets, what do we feel is a public good? What do we feel is open for profit? What do we feel is worth paying for? What's the models to pay for it? Unintended consequences, the fabulous AOL search data. AOL and a little group in AOL research said, hey, we'll take all our search logs. They don't have usernames. They don't have passwords. We'll take all the user logs and we'll make it available for the research community. Well, the New York Times got a hold of it, and they found out that people do really interesting things like do searches on their social security number. And they do interesting things on, and by taking the same IP addresses, suddenly you can uniquely identify people. And so when you have data at scale, things become possible by integrating data from different sources that we didn't know we could do before. Things like keeping, I don't know, email and IM messages from congressmen. You know? Everyone familiar with DOPA, the Delete Online Predators Act, where we're going to, you know, filter out social networks? I think we need to, like, you know, Protect Us from Congressmen Act. But security, e-voting and die bulb machines. I'll leave it there. Preservation and migration and emulation. I have there the abandoned grad student at DRI, Desert Research Institute. They have a grad student who wants to do this wonderful study where he has a model, and he wants to look at how accurately he predicts the weather. And the data to do it is sitting on a tape drive behind a proprietary piece of software that is no longer supported and broken. Right? He cannot graduate until he rewrites the software from scratch to get at his data. Right? So we know these issues. Culture and control. What Google goes to China. Once we have all this massive scale data, how can we influence society? And these are some interesting, these for me get to the real massive scale issue. How do we, librarians, organize and work in a world where we have cognition and perceptual scarcity? What does that mean? Scarcity of information used to mean the information was scarce. Now it means our ability to process the information is scarce. And so this is Saul Werman's. A weekday edition of the New York Times contains more information than the average person was likely to come across in a lifetime in 17th century England. More information has been produced in the last 30 years than in the previous 5,000 years, and that's accelerating. I don't have time to read it all. You know, maybe you guys do. Good luck with that. And when you talk about truly massive scale, scalability and sustainability become very, very different. This is from last month's Wired magazine. Ask.com operations VP Dwayne Sampson estimates that the five leading search companies, right, Google and Microsoft and Ask and all these people we love, together have 2 million servers, each shedding 300 watts of heat annually, a total of 600 megawatts. These are linked to hard drives that dissipate perhaps another gigawatt, 50% again as much power is required to cool the computers as to do the processing. So with a third of the power already lost to the grid's inefficiency and half of what's lost to power supplies, transformers, and converters, the total of electricity consumed by major search engines in 2006 approaches 5 gigawatts, or enough power to power Las Vegas metropolitan area with hotels, casinos, restaurants, convention centers at the hottest day of the year. In heat, in loss. Google is building a massive data complex, and they're building it in Oregon. Why? Because it's next to the Colorado River where they can get hydroelectric power. Because Ask.com built it in Virginia, and half of their data center is empty, not because they don't want to fill it up. They don't have enough power from the metropolitan DC area to power it. That's the scale that we are talking about. All right. So what are our options as librarians in this world at that scale? Number one, we'll catalog it. That is the right reaction. We tried it. It didn't work. If anyone remembers Cork, collaborative online resource cataloging, the notion of doing a MARC record, even a Dublin Core record about a web page that's going to disappear in 10 seconds after you're done, or probably 30 seconds before it goes through the committee on approving this metadata schema, it's not an option. Now, I want to be real clear. This is not an anti-Gorman, I hate cataloging speech. I think there's stuff that deserves that level of attention and description. I think a little sensor sitting in a roadway somewhere in South Carolina, probably not so. So the notion that we can take this massive information and catalog it is misguided. This is the other one we tend to do. We can ignore it. The idea that, oh, but that's okay, Dave. We don't, that's not our problem. By the way, the science community in the middle of this, physics, meteorology, simulations, are desperate for help. They recognize this as a key problem. And what they are doing, and this is going to come as no surprise, is they're reinventing our field to try and do it. Right? So it's not like if we have a choice here. Right? It's not that we will be ignored. Notice, it is not we will be ignored. That's why I'm here today, to make sure that that does not happen. But we could ignore it. If we do, we worry about the idea of the commercialization of data stewardship. And this is not, don't come with the 10-point list. Chronicle of Higher Education talked about the Google Book Project, and their fear wasn't the fact that Google wasn't going to make it accessible and these libraries weren't going to happen. It's what if Google goes out of business? What happens to that data? Where's the durability of the data? How's the lasting part of the data? We're in the infrastructure business. What's our role for the future generations? And ultimately, potentially, the dissolution of libraries and institution, or a continued reduction to be a niche player. We're the book people, right? I'm in serials collection, right? We already know we don't just do books. But the notion that, there's that world, but this is ours. This is our world. If you need our world, we'll be here waiting for you. It doesn't feel really like a good option to me. We could limit the library. By becoming a niche player, what we do is we say the job of a library is high-quality information, only published information, document-like object, call it whatever you want. By the way, you can dress it up however you want, but ultimately you are getting into an interesting discussion of selectivity versus intellectual freedom. Is the role of a library to be a selective, curated collection Or is it to make information available to our community service? Because if it is the latter, then the notion of saying we are in the selection business when all the technical hurdles about collecting everything are gone, you no longer have that argument. Now, a strategic advantage could be to say, you know, why are we select? Why do we weed collections? Why do we take journals out of, why do we not buy journals anymore? Why do we drop subscriptions? We don't have the resources. We don't have the money. We don't have, what we're saying is we would if we could, but we can't. But what happens if you can? What does the world look like then? Or, obviously why I'm here, we can embrace it. I think that there is a great opportunity that we'll talk about in a little bit for the librarians of the world to assert themselves into this new generation. Our skills are desperately needed. The problem is massive. The rewards are great. It is time for us to get involved. In fact, I would argue, putting the onus on the professor up here, that it is, in fact, unethical of us to prepare librarians that don't think about this issue. That if we graduate students that don't think at the scale of terabytes per second, we actually have hindered them and we have hindered the entire community of librarians in what they can perform. We have, in essence, said, yes, there are these great opportunities, and we are limiting you because we are going to stick with the small stuff. Now, how do we embrace it? We are involved currently in a project called Participatory Networks and Participatory Librarianship. And if you go to the URL there at the Information Institute, you can read about a nice paper talking about this. But what it does is it requires a fundamental shift in our thinking, and I'm going to try and point that out, about what it is we do. I think it's very rare to find someone to say, the library's in the knowledge business. I think it's very rare to have someone stand up and go, no, we're not. Screw knowledge. We don't like knowledge. Libraries are in the knowledge business. Our job is knowledge. Whether our job is enhancing the knowledge of our communities in a public discourse or our academies or our businesses or what have you, we're in the idea of the knowledge business. We gather it, we sort it, we help create it. We facilitate knowledge. There's this wonderful thing called conversation theory by a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask who says, in a well thought out but very obscure book, that talks about knowledge is created through conversation. The way you create knowledge is you talk about it. Now, this is a scalable idea. Before I get myself into trouble, that can mean I'm talking to you on a one-on-one. That can mean I'm talking to you in the mass. It can mean I'm talking to myself, which I do a lot, and it scares people. Right? For those, you know, library instruction people out there, the idea of metacognition, thinking about how you think, the idea of literally saying, do I turn left or right? Well, if I turn left, it'll be fat. That's a conversation. Conversations can happen amongst institutions. That's what licensing negotiations are. They're conversations about priorities and resources. Can happen between countries, nations, can happen between societies. And they have variable length. One could very well argue that we are in a conversation that lasts millennia. What is the nature of life? What is the nature of religion? Those are conversations that span generations.
5 minutes.
You're kidding me. That artifacts are simply a byproduct of these conversations. That the mission of a participatory library is to facilitate the knowledge creation of the community through conversation. We're in the conversation business. We're not in the thing business. Now, this is not a radical idea. There was this little guy hanging out, and he didn't have a wise choice in what he drank. But Socrates talked about how we gather knowledge in the conversation back and forth. And more modern examples, we can talk about things like, well, we have book groups, and we have programs with speaker series and story times. We have reference, for God's sake. We're talking all the time. Right? So it may seem natural. We might say things like, oh, Dave, of course we're in the conversation business. Done. Thank you. Right? But I would argue also things like collection development and preservation are part of the conversation business. The collection that you, the journals that you pick, the books that you buy, the resources you make available, the open access journals you link to are a conversation that you build within your community about what's important and how it's important. Right? Now, there is, however, I call it the hidden, but the not so hidden item focus that we have as a profession. You see it in LIS theory development, which there isn't much LIS theory development. And when there are, they do things like, well, it's all about, they look at co-citation analysis and bibliographic and bibliometric studies, which has really core, good intellectual scholarly thinking, but then they say, well, what about reference? Well, that's over here. And what about preservation? Well, that goes sort of down here. And we don't have this wonderful grand unified theories of libraries because we don't quite see how bits and pieces fit together. When you look at how we evaluate things, do we evaluate them by the collection? Do we evaluate reference differently? How do we integrate our different evaluation streams? We look at Cork and LII. The Librarians Index of the Internet, it's a great resource, but it's a thing resource. We go through the selection process and we pick out this website and it sits here pristine. Not that it fits within a context. Why do people go to there? When do they go there? Right? There's Karen Snyder, bibliofundamentalism is her term, and I love it. It's an extreme that sees the role of libraries as a haven of order and quality, and that the ultimate focus is on collections, and I think that's not a scalable model. That when you, what do you do about that road data? And you go, oh, Dave, we don't care about road data. Well, do you have patrons that do? Do you have researchers who work in that? And by the way, do you care about your taxpayer dollars? Do you care about all these things? The idea of how we limit stuff, well, we limit them by our community needs. Do we? Or do we limit them by our resources available? And what happens if I begin removing those resources? So I want to just quickly walk you through how to think about integrating things, artifacts, but them as secondary to the conversation. So we have Bernard and Sally here. And Bernard's going to ask a question. Did it rain on June 18th in Yellowstone National Park? And Sally, our reference librarian, is going to helpfully say, why, yes, it did. And Bernard is going to say, how sure are you that he did? Now, simply saying yes isn't. So when we say, how sure are you, or why do you say that? Because the idea is there are parts of Yellowstone that don't have the report, weather report on them. Well, Sally says, well, I got that from a model that someone produced on precipitation, and they estimated that it rained on this date at this time. That output is based itself on a mathematical model that has lots of assumptions, variables of things like precipitation, humidity, temperature, altitude, dispersion, all these kinds of things. So when you can actually say, I am 93.25% sure that it rained at that point, right? And those, in fact, are based on a series of data, things like balloon data. Still in this country, twice a day, we take these big balloons and we shoot them in the air and they say, it's not raining today, right? We can take satellite data that shows, well, there was these clouds and this information, satellite data that today we use to find out where the conference center is. Weather readings and weather reports, terabytes and terabytes of data. When you look at that, yes, and you follow its stream down, you're suddenly into the world of not a paper, not an article, not a reference resource. You're in the middle of a petascale computing problem. How sure are you that model? Because that model came from people who are themselves having conversations. So you're in the people business. It's a conversation that's happening. And you might say, well, why do we care about this, Dave? He just asked if it was whatever. Well, Bernard himself had to take that data into court. And he had to take that data into court because the insurance company was being sued by a guy who slipped off the road in Yellowstone National Park and crashed. And he needed to say, it's because it was raining. And the insurance company says, no, it wasn't. And so he had to go and get this kind of data. Now, this track, there are lots of items and bits and things and artifacts, but they're irrelevant to the conversation that's ongoing. All right? By the way, privacy, individual, whatever. I think there are interesting things to be thought about with privacy. I'm personally not a person who believes that privacy is a yes or no answer. I think there's this nice continuum of privacy where people are willing. I mean, Bernard's perfectly willing to say, I'm going into court to do this because he's going to have a public document produced out of it. So why not allow that conversation to go back into the library for the next person looking at that information? This is the notion of a participatory library system. Yeah. I got 5 more minutes from it.
Questions.
Yeah, see you over lunch. All right. I'll go through this quickly. The participatory library system, we're moving, and I think there's some excellent stuff at this conference talking about what we need to think about with building a system that handles the large-scale data in a conversation level. If you look at this far left-hand side, we have a lot of systems right now today. We have the catalog. We have user data, such as circulation data. We have digital catalogs, which I always love. You know, that's where our e-books are and things that we can't somehow come up with a MARC record for. We have databases, which are our number one used resources in many cases. We have external feeds and sites and resources. We now have institutional repositories and open access repositories. We have digitization, preservation, reference system, virtual reference systems, and increasingly with the Library 2.0 people, we're talking about hosted communities like blogs and wikis and such for the community. The problem is right now, they all sort of sit in their own silos, and we're asking our users to navigate amongst them. Now, What's great is the library is having a conversation. This is a product of continued conversations. Oh, we need this. Oh, we don't. And so we're looking at constant evolution. And you see some of the initial in that second row, evolution. Taking catalog and user data together to create Amazon.com-like catalogs, where you can bring up a book and see annotations. You can see if it's available in other places. You can see book reviews on it. We see digital catalogs, databases, and external feeds being thought about in the federated search world, so you can put in one search and have it across all our resources. Institutional repositories and digitization and preservation systems are quickly merging to be digital repositories. So, and then knowledge bases. And they're all beginning to be synthesized to where right now we're talking about moving to a true catalog, where you can go to your library, do a search, and it says, here's some books we have, here's some articles we have, here's something on Google that we have, here's this information for you. But it's metadata-based. And we have these community repositories, which is our content stuff. This is stuff that we scanned or produced or housed. And what we see is the ultimate goal is to merge them together, to smack them together to be the same. So some examples. We've already talked about Bernard and Sally's little adventure through the library. That conversation and the associated data and link to the data are part of the participatory library system. When you go and search for weather data in Yellowstone, you will not simply get a book on it. You will also get the transcript of the conversation that they had, plus the URLs that you can follow. And when we have another researcher who comes in and searches for weather data in Yellowstone, it turns out they're a meteorologist PhD teaching the topic, and they say, I didn't find a good discussion about that model you used. I wrote a paper on it. I'm going to upload it. And not upload it to the repository that gets listed. They're going to upload it to the library. And the minute they upload that data, it becomes available to everyone in the library. And we're going to get someone else who comes in and is looking for an interesting reading, and they're going to search for a book, and they're going to find a book, and it's going to have discussions and annotations, maybe have the full text right there, and it's going to have the idea that if you're really interested in the book, there's a book club on it next Thursday. And that goes in the library system. The idea that the library system isn't our pristine order of metadata, our pristine catalogs. It's a wide open participatory system where we let anyone that the community deems right to enter data, move data, delete data, yes, delete data out of the catalog. They can get rid of it. And so what we end up with is Bernard, again, going to the library, and when the library gives them an answer, either through reference services or directly through self-help, that library answer comes from their local resources, it comes from a network of other libraries that are doing the same, it comes from web resources, it comes from institutions and humanities data. We didn't talk about that. We talked about science data. The humanities are looking at this going, do you want to see data? I got data! We'll scan for the rest of your life and you won't know what to do with all this postmodern analysis that we're going to do. Right? And these massive scale data sources. But the idea is that Bernard isn't just going to do a keyword search and hope for metadata to lead them. He's going to do a search. Some of that search is going to be broken into metadata, some of it not, some of it in full text, and he's going to find a conversation. And when he finds a resource, he's going to be able to say, tell me what everyone else, either anonymously or highly known, was doing with this data so I can follow their conversation. And he can recreate a conversation in the system. And by the way, I want to be really clear, and I have two more slides, that he should be able to do this not only when he goes to the library, but any of those web resources as well. I love the fact that Charleston Conference has an online conference site. I hate the fact that I've got to go there, and I've got to go to my WebCT class, and I'm over here in MySpace, and I've got this, right? The notion that we create these plethora of, I mean, I have too many social networks to be social with, right? So why not say, if you love MySpace, I mean, if you love MySpace and you have a Hello Kitty phone, that's where, and you're a 48-year-old male, and that's where you should interact with the library. That you should be able to put a nice little search box right there and be able to search and have it come back in your interface. That the library is, in essence, everywhere, and that what's coming back isn't just, well, you can search our catalog anywhere. You can search the library, whether it shows you a physical resource or a digital resource, and it's all within one system, and some of it's using full-text searching and otherwise. We need to engage on this problem. If we do not, if we ignore the implications, it is dangerous because we abdicate serious decisions and consequences to others. But ultimately, the reason that we as librarians must engage on this problem is that it's an opportunity to not only enhance what we do, but proactively position librarians at the forefront of the information field where they belong. Never be satisfied when you go to a conference and you hear too many things on why we should think about maybe getting... Forget it. Do it. It's time for librarians to say, you have an information problem and we are an information solution. Yes, it's done on a computer. Yes, it's done with massive scale networks. Yes, it's done with things that we can't understand the intricate bits and bytes of. But if you don't have us at the table, you are going to be in trouble. You're not going to be able to find your data. You're not going to be able to use your data. And as a society that is now dependent on digital and electronic resources, it is too important for you not to have librarians at the table. It is too important for you to take this casually, to simply worry about a series of functions and walk away from it. You must be aware that information organizations, conversations, and libraries are essential to the well-functioning society that we live in. That's what we're doing. Thank you very much.
Sorry, people, I don't think we have time for questions.
I'm here.
David will be in coffee. Through the door there. But if we had questions,
I'll stand right here.
There's so many questions that have come up. They're so big questions, because these are all big questions. I don't think we can have them. So I would like to thank him, of course, and just thank him. The coffee coming up now is sponsored by the American Chemical Society.